Welcome to Anaesthesia on Air, the official podcast from the Royal College of Anaesthetists. My name's Dr. Ramai Santhrapala, and I'm an elected council member at the Royal College of Anaesthetists and also a consultant anaesthetist at Guy's and St Thomas's NHS Foundation Trust. I'm delighted to say that I'm here with Dr. Claire Shannon. We're recording this the day before Claire takes up the role of president of the Royal College of Anaesthetists. By the time you hear this, Claire will be our president. To prepare for this podcast, we invited the membership engagement panel, comprised of hundreds of RCOA members, to pose questions to Claire. Some of the questions we received were along similar lines, so we selected representative examples and themes. I'll be asking those questions alongside a few of my own, my prerogative as host. So Claire, first of all, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Congratulations on being elected as our president here at the Royal College of Anaesthetists. I'll kick off with the obvious question. What does being president mean to you?
Thanks very much, Ramai. Well, first of all, I'm deeply honoured and humbled to have been elected. For me, my profession, being an anaesthetist, has been a huge part of my life. And the college is important for our profession to maintain standards and teaching and training, as well as through work to improve standards of practice and safety for patients. I've worked at and with the college throughout much of my consultant career, quite a lot of it in training roles. And I was until fairly recently an FRCA examiner. And I think somehow that's equipped me with some understanding of the challenges anaesthetists in training have in their career, and other doctors as well. And it's also made me understand how difficult it's become to access the necessary training in some places. I also understand the stresses associated with sitting the exams on top of all of this. So I guess it made sense to me that I should continue to use my knowledge, skills and networks to provide leadership as president. As I've said, it's a huge honour and I'm really quite humbled, to be honest, but also a bit excited perhaps, and I'm keen to get going. There's a lot to be done and we're at a critical point.
For those who might not know your leadership journey, do you mind just giving us a potted history of your career?
So I'm a consultant anaesthetist in London. I subspecialise in paediatric cardiac anaesthesia, and I've worked at Guy's and St Thomas's Trust and now Evelina Hospital, which since 1997, Evelina is part of the Guy's and St Thomas's Trust, and it's the paediatric hospital. I've already said I've had roles in training, and I have in fact been college tutor, TPD, regional advisor and head of school in the past. And I think gaining the knowledge of the curricula and training pathways has always interested me. I suppose the challenge of trying to sort out a problem, see through improvements and mitigate the effects of inevitable less than favourable changes to the systems has always appealed to me. So on joining council 6 years ago, I decided to get involved in the other aspects of the college work, in particular standards of practice. I didn't know a great deal about that side of the college, so I felt it was important to learn it. And so I sat on the ACSA committee. I got involved in patient safety work and joined the Clinical Quality and Research Board, which I came eventually to chair before being elected as vice president. So I've had quite a long journey through various aspects of college work.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask you, who is Claire when she's not at work?
Right, okay. Well, I'm a woman, I'm a wife, a mother, and now with three grown-up children that, incidentally, I'm enormously proud of. No medics, I'm sad to say. My first child was born not long after I took up my consultant job, so I completely understand the balancing act of being a good parent with childcare, parents' evenings, summer holidays, sick kids, and trying to manage that and develop one's career as well. I'm not a Londoner by background. I'm from Northern Ireland, and I'm quite proud of my cultural background, although I don't get many opportunities to go home, as I still call it. I actually haven't lived there for 40 years, but it doesn't really feel like it. And I'm delighted to see our flagship conference is going to be in Belfast next spring. So looking forward to that. And for anybody who's interested, here goes the sales pitch. May 2025, Anesthesia 25 in Belfast. I suppose where I spend the rest of my life, I guess I've come to realise how important maintaining health and well-being is. All my family are mad keen sports fans. And significantly better at sports than I am. I'm not hugely accomplished at any particular sport, but enjoy participating and watching most of them. I love to run. It kind of is very good for my physical and mental health, I think. I do a bit of yoga, but not often enough, I guess, and a bit of cycling at the weekends, which has been encouraged by my cycle-mad husband. And in fact, I've recently joined a cycling club, so I'm really loving that at the moment.
That's fantastic. Let's speak to wellbeing, which you picked up just now. The GMC National Training Survey obviously reports on wellbeing and other challenging issues within our specialty, and speaks specifically to burnout through the burnout inventory that's measured every year. What would you advise anaesthetists in training through to kind of SAS consultants anaesthetists with regards to wellbeing? This is a demanding specialty. You've obviously done over and above and have extensive experience in this space. And you're someone that actually a lot of people look to in that aspect, because you are someone who comes across as incredibly balanced. So what would you say to those members?
Well, I guess I would say I've actually made mistakes here myself. So I do understand. There have been times in the past where I perhaps didn't attend to my own health and well-being as well as I should have. I suspect I felt it was risky to admit I wasn't feeling good and that I would somehow be letting myself down. But that wasn't a good strategy, I don't think. Like many, I found the period around exams particularly stressful. And that was at a time when I was working frequent on-call rotas. And I know trainees nowadays have similar exhausting times, commuting and working shifts. And equally, returning from mat leave into work again, it was much harder than I imagined. Physically, with little sleep at home and very little sleep at work, and also mentally, that separation from a baby, it's quite difficult. So I guess my advice would be, if you're feeling a bit like that, do talk to people, something I wasn't very good at doing, but would advise it to people, whether that's at home, family, friends, or at work to your colleagues. You know, sharing is really helpful, because you find that you're not alone and lots of other people are having stresses and strains. Don't forget your ES and your CT are always there to pick up things that may be affecting more than just your clinical curricular outputs. So do talk to them. They won't mind and they'll be helpful. And in fact, if your department has a wellbeing lead and the college is working to encourage more of these, they will be able to signpost you to resources that you may find helpful. And don't forget, if you feel you're heading to a crisis point, there are support services designed to help. So, for example, the BMA have a useful support line, and NHS Practitioner Health run a really excellent program to support doctors.
I think also the GMC National Training Survey and certainly other data that's come out, particularly from the GMC, but not exclusively, speaks to some other more challenging issues within our specialties. We're both women within specialties. You yourself have described a number of leadership roles that you've held and the journey through them. What do you think are the challenges for women?
So I think there's a couple of broad themes here, and I think it's come to light and publicly in the media lately. The first is overcoming existing sexism and the negative culture in the systems within which we work, and much has been written recently about some of these challenges. And it certainly comes out in the GMC National Training Survey. But I also read recently a really good survey from the BMA called Sexism in Medicine. And this emphasized the prevalence. And I was shocked to see that from that report, over 90% of respondents had experienced sexism in the workplace in the previous 2 years. Quite shocking, really. But this translates. And I think there's many female anaesthetists like myself who have grown used to patients assuming that the male ODP is the consultant as they are wheeled into the anaesthetic room and that doctors are the men in the room. I have to say, ladies, that gets better as you get older. I've got one other anecdote, if I may, and that's I have a surgical colleague who is a professor and a leader in her specialty, and she was being interviewed by the BBC with another male surgical professor, and both in the names on the screen and in the verbal introductions, the interviewer referred to her by her first name only, and the male colleague was referred to as professor. There we are. So sadly, this sort of cultural and systemic sexism is still common. And so the second bit is the other issue I think that women face, and that is the voice from within. And the imposter syndrome and being able to challenge your self-doubt. And I think that's quite prevalent as well. So what I would say to that is believe in yourself, recognize your achievements, and just don't allow the internal critics or the external system put you off.
Yeah, and I'll definitely say on a personal note, Claire has been a great advocate and... yeah, just very empathetic, I guess, to the issues that we all face. And I think one aspect is it's not about being at the table, it's bringing the voice to the table.
Yeah, and as a woman leader, there's also the importance of the role you're occupying in representing the extraordinary, talented and able women coming behind you. And there's something about if you can't see it, you can't be it. And I will do the very best job with this that I can.
Yeah, lift as you climb. So, you know,
totally.
As they say, I may be the first, but I won't be the last.
Yeah.
So, Claire, following on from our discussions about women in leadership, also born from national data, but also something that we both know is close to our hearts, is equality, diversity, and inclusion. Where do you think we are as a specialty, and how do we ensure that we're equitable and inclusive?
Thank you. This is a really important subject to speak about. We're a big college. We've got over 26,000 members from all different cultures, backgrounds, ages, gender identities, and so on. And that's kind of reflective of our patients too. So I think it's important we ensure we understand and reflect this diversity and we become inclusive. I think this is about respecting people and promoting the environments that are inclusive so that people can be as productive and effective as possible. So currently at the college, we're undertaking work to address these issues in many areas. And this is not a comprehensive list of things, but just to sort of give the listeners examples. So, for example, the exams. We're making some changes to the language used in the questions so that they are clearer, particularly to candidates who, for whom English is not their first language. We are taking good steps to diversify our examiner pool, and we're making the participation for the exam for examiners more flexible and suitable to those with caring commitments. So when I was an examiner, you were signed up to examine for at least 2 weeks a year and 2 weeks at a time. And I believe we've loosened those rules to make it much more amenable to people. And the second thing we're doing is we're working with the Widening Participation Medics Network in our GAS Reach program to provide opportunities for medical students and doctors in training from underrepresented backgrounds. And of course, then, and importantly, we're also deeply involved in the sexual misconduct in surgery working party. And indeed, all of this is reflected in the college values, which I'm embarrassed to say I had to look up, but actually it pertains to the just and fair college value. And in my presidency, I would like to see a measurable improvement in diversity and inclusion, and particularly around exams.
Thanks very much. We're going to move on to some specific member questions. So I wanted to start with a question from Varisan Ganesha Lingam. Sounds like a fellow Sri Lankan who's also an anaesthetist in training. And this is going to come as perhaps no surprise, but what is your stance on anaesthesia associates and what do you think their scope of practice should be?
Yeah, well, I'm not surprised to receive that question. And actually, thank you very much for asking it. I recognise this has caused an enormous amount of debate and anguish across the college membership. And I understand those concerns that our members have had about the AA roles and particularly the proposed expansion in the numbers outlined in the long-term workforce plan. I just want to say, over the last year or so, we've really focused on listening to and understanding those concerns, which include patient safety and training capacity. And that's why we called for a pause in the expansion so that we can do that work and we can address those concerns. It's also worth saying that the college is responsible for safeguarding standards in anaesthesia. And to do that, I think it's vital that we retain our responsibility for leadership and guidance on education, training, and professional development of AAs. I think that's in the best interest of anaesthetists, of AAs, and of course, patients, who are a very important part of our charter. On the scope of practice piece, well, we've just about to publish a draft scope of practice. It will go out for consultation shortly, and I do hope members will respond to that. Speaking on behalf of Council, we think that it's a workable and safe scope of practice for AAs, both at the point of qualification and beyond, including, and importantly, the required levels of supervision. And I know this is something that members are particularly concerned about. The draft scope of practice is something that we've already done a lot of consultation on as part of its development. And we've included the Association of Anaesthetists and RA UK in that development. And we've also been working with a clinical reference group which has wide representation. So I think what we've arrived at will enable AAs to continue to deliver patient care under supervision, while also addressing the concerns we've heard from members about patient safety. And finally, I think it's important to say something about AAs. I would just like to say that through all of this, we recognise the contribution AAs make and have made to patient care and will make in the future. And I do acknowledge the impact, which is not good, and this has had on all of them.
I think along the same lines, or to segue to Shivan Patel, who is also an anaesthetist in training, who'd like to know what's being done to ensure the training of anaesthetists is being prioritised, specifically referring to the SD4 bottleneck.
Yeah, thank you very much for that one. There's been work in this area too that we will continue. And I'd just like to say that our very active training committee and our anaesthetists and training committee have been working with networks that are pre-existing, and I mean our RAs and TPDs, to get a shared understanding of how we move forward with this and what the best solutions could be. What we know is anaesthetists in training need to have prioritised access to the best possible training opportunities. It's not happening everywhere terribly well, and so supporting that training is a key role for the college. And we've also provided support by advising on what anaesthetists in training and trainers should do if they find they can't access training opportunities or have concerns about training capacity. So those are two things that are sitting alongside some more direct work on training pathways. So on the bottlenecks, we're working on two fronts. One is to push NHSE and the government to fund more higher training places. It makes no sense to me that we have people who are partially trained in an environment where we haven't got enough anaesthetists, and they can't, despite the best will in the world, further that training. It's a nonsense. The second is to increase flexibility in training where we can. And for example, with more people choosing less than full-time training, we're working with training program directors to help them maximise the use of slot shares so we can free up more ST4 places from within existing programs. We've also enabled schools of anaesthesia to recognise up to 12 months of prior learning outside of the training program to enable faster progression once back in it. And we're supporting alternative pathways, including approval and recognition of portfolio pathways.
I think that's a nice segue into a question from Hadik Sharma, who's also an anaesthetist in training. He asks, has the college given consideration to turning anaesthesia training into a run-through program, given that we're a singular specialty, unlike other specialties such as medicine and surgery?
Yeah, that's an interesting question too. And one of the things one of the consequences of my long-term involvement in training and education is I can remember when run-through training existed in our specialty. And what we found is it didn't allow enough flexibility for trainees. So, for example, if a trainee needed more time, for example, for the exams, there was a very significant risk they might not reach their training targets and would have to leave the programme. And in that case, it was then very difficult for them to get back in. So there was no place for them. In addition, trainees actually, after core training, do like to have a pause. Many of our trainees have come straight into medicine, straight through foundation programs, and into the specialty without a break. And I think increasingly, younger generations of doctors do like to take a break. With run-through training, it's not obvious how they then get back into the program and regain their place to carry on their training. But we do recognize that things have maybe changed a bit. There's now more flexibility within the training programs with OOPC and OOPE, and there's more flexibility around exams in that we've been able to allow trainees to resit exams even though they're gaining higher training competencies. So there are more options to support progression points when they're not achieved. And also, it's more possible now, if that's the right phraseology, to move training programs geographically if there are domestic or personal circumstances that require a change. So although I recognise there are pros and cons on both sides, we need to make sure that we make a proper assessment of those before we make any changes. But I have to say, our training committees and our anaesthetists and training committees are talking about this. So I think the short answer might have to be watch this space.
I'm going to move on to just a couple of quick fires before we close. So we've got a question from a medical student and said, as the president of the Royal College of Anaesthetists, will you be making any efforts towards undergraduate engagement with the specialty? Some examples being regional conferences or workshops.
Well, first of all, it's really brilliant that we've got medical students who are in fact engaging in our membership panel. That's brilliant to see that there's an interest in our specialty. So thank you very much for tabling that question. In fact, we already do run courses who are for doctors considering a career in anaesthesia, and they're targeted specifically to foundation doctors and undergraduate doctors. And in fact, the next one, I'm told, is on the 16th of October. They're free for members of our college, so if you want to join the college, we would really welcome your membership. It costs just £10 to join the college, and this is yet another sales pitch, so I apologise about that. They're for medical students or foundation doctors, so please, please join. You'll find lots of resources on our website that may help.
So a foundation year doctor, and they ask, what can foundation trainees do to help boost their portfolio if their aspiration is a career in anaesthesia?
Well, the first thing to do, I think, is to go and talk to some of the anaesthetists within your department. And it doesn't actually matter if they're consultants or not. You may already have met a few of the core trainees if you're a foundation doctor. So they will give you a really good idea of the sorts of things that you should be looking at, you know, perhaps courses that would be useful for you to go on to understand the profession. And I think if you're in a foundation post that is in an acute medical specialty, there are many areas where there is an overlap, particularly in the preoperative setting. So perhaps managing pre-op assessments, those sorts of things. And so the other thing would be to talk to the consultants. But I'm really pleased that you are looking to the college for some support and hope that we will be able to provide you with a bit more of that on our website.
Absolutely. So it's understanding the kind of practicalities of what it's like to be in a specialty and knowing that that's a commitment you want to make, and then looking for transferable opportunities, which certainly as a previous ACCS trainee I can only advocate for as well. So we're going to bring this to a close, regrettably, because I feel like I could talk to you for another hour or so, Claire, but I know you're a busy woman, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to close with If you were to talk to your younger self, perhaps when you were just starting in anesthesia, what would be three pieces of advice that you would give the younger Dr. Shannon?
Okay, so three pieces of advice, right. I think the first one might be try not to worry too much. Just do the job you're doing. Do it as well as you can. And understand there are patients at the end of everything you do. So put yourself in their place. Imagine you're the patient. And just give the kind of care that you would like if it was you. That's number one. I think number two might be just to believe in yourself. And I think that speaks a little bit to the imposter syndrome. Just believe you're good enough. Enjoy your job. Anesthesia has always been a brilliant career and will continue to be so. And the third thing is look after yourself and make sure you stay fit and well and healthy and happy.
That's brilliant. Thanks very much, Claire, for your time. It's been an absolute delight.
Thank you very much. It's been my pleasure.
So all that remains is to thank you, our listeners, for listening. The podcast accompanies an interview with Claire in the October 2024 Royal College of Anaesthetists member bulletin. Incidentally, that will be my last as editor. We'll post a link in the description alongside any other links that may be useful. For more podcasts like this, make sure you subscribe to Anaesthesia on Air and review us whilst you're there.